Hello and welcome to the Big COC podcast. This is our episode 3, and today I'm here with 3 illustrious guests. We're very happy to welcome back Wayne Gooding, who's the editor of Opera Canada magazine. And as I've said before, he's also a member of our speakers bureau here at the COC, and he's a seasoned opera traveler, and he'll have some stories today about his recent travels. And then joining us for the first time today is Joseph So. Joseph is Professor Emeritus from Trent University, and he now enjoys a second career as a freelance journalist on things operatic. And you can find his wonderful writings in Opera Canada magazine, La Scena Musicale, and also the British Opera magazine. Welcome, Joseph. It's great to have you here.
Great to be here.
And our very special guest, it's like those sitcoms where you have the very special episode, is soprano Tamara Wilson, who is here in Toronto appearing as Rosalinda in our new production, the COC's new production of Die Fledermaus, which opens on October 4th. Welcome, Tamara.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure for sure. And my name is Gianmarco Segato. I'm the Adult Programs Manager here at the COC. I'm just going to start again with a short reminder of how you can listen to the podcast. There are many easy ways. The easiest is probably to go to our website. Check out COC Radio, which is on the homepage. The tab is on the top right. You just click there, and we have a myriad of wonderful things to listen to and look at on COC Radio, including these podcasts. You can also visit our podcast page, which you can link to from the homepage. And the advantage of that is that you can actually download the files from there onto your device of choice. And we are on iTunes, of course, so you can go to your iTunes page, check out Canadian Opera Company in the search engine, and these podcasts will come up. And that's probably a wonderful way, especially to subscribe to the podcast, so that every time there's a new one, you'll be notified. And I thought, we've had a couple episodes now, and I'm not sure if you people are aware of what our theme music is, but we're not going to give it away.
Okay.
There's a really great rousing theme at the beginning of the podcast, and I thought, just to sort of see who's listening and stir up some excitement, we would have a little contest. So if there's anyone listening who knows where this theme music comes from, and you know, if you can even go as far as saying what character it's connected with, but especially which opera it comes from, you could email us at community@coc.ca. And the prize is courtesy of Universal Classics. I should mention again that Universal is the sponsor of these podcasts, and it's Cecilia Bartoli's new CD entitled Mission.
Oh, cool.
Yes, and she's looking very intense on the cover. Have you seen the cover?
I saw a preview of it online. Yeah. It looks fantastic.
Yes.
She was the first artist I ever listened to.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I think she's still amazing, and she explores, you know, uncharted territories. It's exciting. So that's a great prize, and I think you should email us. And you can also use that email address to give us your opinions and suggestions for topics. So I thought we'd start today with a little catch-up with Tamara. I had the pleasure of interviewing you, I think, 3 years ago, Simon Bocanegra, when you were here. Just to remind people, Tamara has been here twice already. She sang Amelia in Simon Bocanegra for us, and then was a very crazed, memorable extra in Idomeneo. I also remember you putting on the lipstick.
Yeah, everybody, it's so funny, I came back into town and everybody's like, you were the lipstick person, right? I was like, yeah.
That was a great performance. You've been singing all amazingly big roles lately, Aida, Leonora and Trovatore, Elizabeth de Valois in Don Carlos in the French version, Miss Jessel. So all the big guns you're singing, it sounds like.
I kind of jumped into a niche pretty early. I figured when I'd start out, I'll just do all the Mozart ladies for like 10, 15 years. No, okay.
It's wonderful.
It's Verdiland.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm especially interested in the Don Carlos, because that was the same production that we had here in Toronto,
yeah.
The
mm-hmm.
same physical production, which was, I think, from Welsh National Opera.
Mm-hmm.
And you sang the role in French. And how was that? I mean, was that the first time you sang the role?
It was my mm-hmm. debut of that role. And I remember starting to learn it, and I'd had like 7 Verdi roles under my belt at that point. So stylistically, I was very used to Verdi,
mm-hmm.
and I started to break it down and learn it. And I was like, oh my goodness, I cannot memorize this in French. Because
oh.
it's just, it felt so weird, because you know what the style is, and then you imagine what the words are in Italian instead of the French words. It's funny, once I started to get into it a little more, the French text was set perfectly because Verdi, of course, was fluent in French,
mm-hmm.
and it was made for the Paris Opera. So it lent itself to be sung easier in mm-hmm. French. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now I'm worried I'm going to go back to the Italian and be all confused.
Do you think that you'll get a chance to sing it in French again? Or I guess that just depends on how
I
things go.
I will, actually. I can't divulge right now, but I will be doing it again in a season or two, yeah.
Wonderful. Mm-hmm. That's great. Because, I mean, I think one of the things about learning some of these Verdi roles in French, there are a couple operas, obviously, where that happens.
Of course. I'm doing Vespri
in
Bilbao in February, and we're doing that in French.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. So you're becoming a specialist in the French Verdi roles. That's wonderful. Do you have any other projects coming up that you can divulge and let us know about?
I have the Bilbao in Spain coming up, the Vespri, mm-hmm. and then I'm going to Houston this spring again for Trovatore.
Mm-hmm. Have you sung that before?
Yes, I sang it at Toulouse mm-hmm. this spring in Mallorca, which was like a mini vacation. It was fantastic. I'd love to sing there all the time. This summer, I sing at the Bach Festival every year. Mm. And it was interesting. My debut with the Bach Festival in Eugene, Oregon, was the Verdi Requiem.
Oh.
I got a call. Yeah, can you do the Verdi Requiem at the Bach Festival? And I was like, are you sure they know what their festival is? But this year, we're doing, in honor of the anniversaries of Wagner and Verdi, we're doing a concert of Wagner and Verdi. So
at the Bach Festival.
I know.
Do they do any Bach?
They do tons of Bach. It's a fabulous festival. I love
Wonderful.
It to death. So I'm doing that. This winter, I'm going to Toulouse again to do Albert Herring, which will be a debut. I'm excited. I get to do two comedic roles in one season. I don't know what to do with myself. I'm so used to being depressed and sad and dying, you know? And then I also make my French recital debut there.
And so how are rehearsals going here for Die Fledermaus?
Swimmingly. We did our first run through on Sunday, mm-hmm. and it's such fun. It's different than the normal Fledermauses I've seen. Fledermice? The concept is a little bit more avant-garde. It's more of a dreamy state, and the Dr. Falke character is very Freudian, which kind of lends it to be a little interesting. It's like an experiment on Eisenstein and Rosalinde's marriage. And then the second act during the party is, it moves in time to this like 1920s huge jazz party. And the costumes are fantastic, and it's just going to look really cool.
Wow, we can't wait. Mm-hmm. We're all just bated breath waiting for that. It's great to have you here, and please just join in whenever you feel like
have
something to
I'll
say.
I'll get my 2 cents.
Now, what we're going to have next is our regular Opera Canada segment. Wayne is here with us, Wayne Gooding again. He's just returned from the Opera.ca conference in Montreal. And I think he has a few things to say about that. Probably should start by telling us what Opera.ca is.
What Opera.ca is, yeah. Well, Opera.ca is essentially the professional association for opera in Canada. It's the association of companies. It has other members, including, for example, Opera Canada Magazine, which is an associate member, and some artist management companies are members as well. But it's really for the performing companies. It used to be called the Professional Opera Companies of Canada as an association. But it's now called Opera.ca, and I went up to their meeting in Montreal in the mid-September. It was also an excuse to open the opera season as well, because Opéra de Montréal opened La Traviata during that weekend. And I thought it would be interesting to talk about, because it's an aspect of opera which we don't hear much about, because we're dealing really with the business of opera. We all love what goes on stage, but we don't perhaps talk enough about what it takes to get everything on stage, and more to the point, what it takes to keep the companies running. So what happens at these meetings, this was the annual meeting of Opera.ca, is that you get together the representatives from pretty well all of the performing companies from coast to coast, or actually effectively it was from Victoria to Quebec City. It's a networking thing in a way, and it's a business meeting, and the kinds of things they're dealing with are marketing issues rather than creative issues. I mean, they are talking creative amongst themselves, and it's a chance for them to get together. And that may sound rather uninteresting and unimportant, but actually it is, because, I think anyway, because the opera industry, one of the problems in Canada is that the opera industry is spread out in a very long line, literally from coast to coast. I mean, and a lot of the companies are serving local audiences, and you kind of forget that there is actually a big picture here. There is an opera business, and the issue is how do the companies work together? What can they do to support each other in times that are not exactly economically the most stable for any of the arts companies. Now, Opera CA had a very important role up until this year in that it administered the Canadian Opera Fund. This was a fund of money which came primarily from the Canada Council, but which was funneled into the creation of new works, new operas. And so the fund would be used for development of ideas, it would be used for bringing operas to the stage, and pretty well every opera, I would say, that's been premiered in Canada over the last 5 years has been supported by this fund. Well, that fund has now come to an end. There is some money still left, and it doesn't mean to say it won't come back again in some form or other. There is some money left to be dispersed, but essentially it's come to an end. So Opera CA itself is in an interesting position at the moment. It's like, how does it support the industry without, now it's not doing that. And I found it very interesting to listen to them in their meetings, because they're talking a lot about cooperation. They're talking a lot about creating a common learning environment for themselves to deal with the issues that all the companies are facing in their own way, marketing issues, subscription issues. I heard time and time again that the subscription model for running a company is now dead, and that you have to look for new ways of bringing in audiences, younger audiences, of reaching audiences, and so on. And so they're all in the same position to dealing with this, but because they're spread out so far, they don't actually get a lot of opportunity to deal with these issues together as a group and to sort of see what might work, what people are doing. And these meetings are therefore, I think, important for that. The other thing that I learned was that there is, and it's part and parcel of this, I think, there is actually a drive now for cooperation on productions. And this is really quite new. Co-productions. There's nothing new about doing co-productions, of course. And there are many people who think that, you know, that except for a very few companies, no one will ever be able to afford to do a new production on their own. No single company do it on its own, and that the co-production is the way to go. So it's already there. But interestingly enough, if you look, the co-productions between Canadian companies are very few and far between. Canadian companies have tended to work with American companies or even European companies. So now they're talking about much more about working together, and I think this is kind of interesting. There are some examples coming up in which, for example, Tapestry New Opera in Toronto is premiering its new opera, Shelter, in Edmonton before it actually does it here in Toronto. That's coming up shortly in Edmonton. It's in Toronto, I think, in February.
Yeah, and we're hoping to actually have them on the podcast pretty soon. And talk about that.
That's right. And in the last podcast, I think I mentioned that Svadba, Queen of Pudding's opera, which I like very much from last year, is actually going on tour to Edmonton, Calgary, and Vancouver. And that's part of this process, too. And I was being told that maybe there is a chance that we're going to now start to see some main stage, larger scale productions that are joint ventures. It's not as easy. It sounds like it's a no-brainer, but it's not as easy as you think, of course, because these things have to be fit into various seasons. And performing spaces aren't all the same size by any means, so your productions have to work in a variety of situations. But that it's happening, I think, is rather important.
I was just thinking that, I mean, you're based in the States, aren't you? Mm-hmm. It seems to me there's more sharing of productions among companies in the United States. And I'm wondering the difference. Why I mean, there's just more companies, I suppose. I mean, Canada, like you say, is so spread out. But or maybe there's more smaller companies that can sort of share similarly sized productions.
True, because we do have certain stages that are quite similar stage-wise, the dimensions and everything, so it's easier to go in on a project. It's just like any investment. You don't want to go full into something if it doesn't give you a return. Mm-hmm. So it's a smart way for a company to have a really new, fun, exciting production, but share a little less of the risk.
Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, and I think that's right. And you raise a question about the point about the disparity of size, and I think that is important here as well. I mean, the opera industry in Canada, is worth probably somewhere between $75 and $100 million. I mean, that's what the value of the economic activity that does. Well, it's not very large when you think that, bank profits are regularly every year $1 billion. So it's not very large, but it's also important to remember things like, the COC itself would account for a third of it, pretty well. So the disparity, most of the companies do no more than 4 productions a year, and some do less than that. So the disparities are enormous. So the practical problems are not easy to overcome. But at least now they're putting I think the companies are now actually resolved to actually try and overcome some of these obstacles in a way that they haven't done it before. The other thing I heard talk of, which I found was very interesting, is that there's much more interest in producing opera festivals for the summer. Quebec City has been doing it now for 2 years. years. It sort of, when they did the 400th anniversary of Quebec City, Grégoire Legendre, the general director of the Opéra de Québec, came up with a number of projects, including Domingo's Operalia competition. And one of them was to sort of try and develop some momentum that would lead, has led to this opera festival, which lasts for, I think, 3-4 weeks, mm-hmm. and has been very, very successful and getting quite a high profile. This year, unfortunately, I couldn't go, but this year it was interesting that they did Thomas Addis's The Tempest.
Yeah, it's the same production.
Production that's going to the Met, not the same cast, but they had Addis over as well. So it's quite high profile. But now I hear talk of a festival coming up out west, or at least an interest in trying to create a summer mm-hmm. festival out west, because there are festivals in Canada, but they tend to be, you know, chamber music or non-operatic. So I think that's very mm-hmm. exciting.
Did you go to the opera festival in Quebec this summer?
No, I didn't.
Oh, okay.
No.
It was interesting because it was such a high-profile production. I think it's partly because Robert Lepage, his studios are mm-hmm. in Quebec City.
That's
so
right.
Mm-hmm. That's why they did that there first.
Yeah. I want to see a few words about co-productions. Yeah. I think that really is so much better than renting a production from, mm-hmm. let's say, another Canadian company. Montreal does that. Like, they've rented the COC, Bluebeer Castle, and Evaton, mm-hmm. and now they're renting the Dutchman.
Right.
But the dimensions often don't fit, you know, from one stage to the next,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
Like they did Rusalka last year, and they rented it from Minnesota, and it didn't fit at all, really.
So then
they
you have to make adjustments and pay more money,
totally.
Which is...
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, I think this Traviata that they just did came from Minnesota as well, and they actually had to adjust that one, too, to make it work
yeah,
in
it's
that.
It's very old.
Yeah.
Very
yeah.
conventional.
Yeah, we have ancient sets.
Yeah. Well, it looked like these grand Parisian salons looked actually more like Roman forums to me.
All patinaed.
Like,
and...
Yes, it was
it's
quite
a concept.
Something. It's a concept.
Yeah.
Well, it reminds me of like when we opened the new opera house here and some of our old productions. I mean, they used them, like the old Bohème, and you know, they had to sort of fill in all the sides because, mm-hmm. I don't know, it just didn't look right.
Yeah.
But it would be a challenge, I think, for within Canada, because some of these theaters out west in like Calgary and Edmonton were these 1960s centennial projects,
right,
and they're
yeah.
sort of all-purpose theaters.
Yes.
And I've actually not been to either of them, but I mean, from what I understand, they're huge, kind of
yes.
barn-like. More like we had at the O'Keeffe Center. The
yeah,
Bird
not
Center.
Quite that barn-like,
no.
but they're going up there. And it's true in Vancouver as well, of course,
right.
with the Queen Elizabeth.
Poor acoustics. They can't really fix it until they change
yeah.
the shape.
Yeah,
yeah.
Mm,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Well, one of the other things I did in Montreal, I had not had a chance to go to the new Symphony Hall, and it just happened that there was a morning concert that I could go to. And I'm sort of used to hearing the Montreal Symphony in Place des Arts, where the opera plays. But boy, this new hall it's such a difference to hear
it
them
is.
In there.
Mm-hmm.
It's a wonderful facility. So yeah, it would be nice. Everyone.
It's Jack Diamond as well.
It's a Jack mm-hmm. Diamond, that's right. Mm-hmm. Same architect as for the Opera House and for...
Kerner.
Yeah.
And is it also Richmond Hill Performing Arts Center?
That's his, right. And St. Petersburg. And
quartering the market on opera houses.
He really is.
They're doing
yeah.
well.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
So moving on here, I had the pleasure this week of speaking with Klaus Heyman, and he's the founder of Naxos Records. And he's in Toronto to promote a new book called The Story of Naxos, The Extraordinary Story of the Independent Record Label That Changed Classical Recording Forever. That's a mouthful. That's the title. It's by Nicholas Soames. He and I chatted about Naxos's 25-year commitment to opera, especially, and all the different forms it's taken under the Naxos umbrella. Here's our chat now. Good morning. Welcome to Toronto. How are you?
Thank you. I'm fine.
Basically, I wanted just to chat a bit about Naxos's history in terms of opera. I know it's progressed and changed over the years, and you've got all sorts of wonderful specialty series. So I just wanted to talk a bit about that this morning.
Okay. Well... As you know, in the beginning, we focused on recording standard opera.
Exactly.
Most of those recordings took place under studio conditions. It means we assembled a cast and we did rehearse, record the way opera used to be done.
Right.
In more recent years, as this became more and more expensive, and also as sales of opera on CD declined because everything moved to opera on DVD,
right.
We focused on live recordings in conjunction with productions people had mounted. For example, and our complete Wagner Ring came from the Stuttgart Opera, and that was basically the soundtrack from the DVD. Now most of the things we do come from the Rossini Festival in Germany.
Right.
both the Rossini operas and their rarities, which they unearth another source of opera is Opera Lafayette in Washington. Mm-hmm. So basically, we switched from recording standard opera under studio conditions to opportunistic live recording possibilities.
Right. What about the history your company has with older recordings? And I think there were a lot of those early on, weren't there?
You talk about our historical series.
Yes, yes.
Well, we still have quite a few of those, and we continue to release a few titles, but the main issue is that because of the weird copyright law in the United States, the world's biggest market for these recordings is not accessible to us.
Oh, I see.
That's why we reduced the number of projects.
Uh-huh.
The United States sound recordings don't enter the public domain until 2067.
Oh boy, it's a few years off still.
Because in the U.S., sound recordings are covered by state common law copyright and not by federal copyright law.
Oh, I understand.
It's underway to change that, but they haven't gotten anywhere yet.
Right. Can you tell me a little bit about your work with certain Canadian companies? I know you've done some with Opera and Concert, for instance, some of the Baroque operas.
Well, that was those were projects with Kevin Mellon.
Right.
But those have become basically impossible to finance since the Canadian dollar became more expensive than the U.S. dollar.
Right. Yeah, there's some disadvantages to that, aren't there, for us?
Yeah, I mean, imports get cheaper, but it's harder for you to sell your manufactured goods or your recorded goods.
Exactly. It sounds like cost is often a big factor in how, especially opera gets recorded, because it requires so many forces. You have, you know, large casts, orchestras. So where do you see this all going in the future?
Well, I think basically costs for video productions are coming down. The video recording equipment has become cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
More and more opera companies want to get their productions released on DVD or streamed online. They come up with more and more attractive offers.
Right.
So, we don't want to enter that market because we distribute all those DVD labels, and I don't want to compete with the labels we distribute. We have Art House, Euro Arts, Opus Art, C Major.
Exactly.
We have, I think, almost 75% market share.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Want to get into competition with them.
Yeah, I'm not sure if some of our listeners may not understand that Naxos not only produces recordings, but you are a distributor for many, many labels as well.
Yeah, we're the world's biggest distributor of classical music labels, both CD and DVD.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, do you have any operatic projects coming up in terms of recordings or recording of live events that you'd like to highlight for us?
Well, what we have in the pipeline, we have just a second. We have Mercadante, Don Quixote from Wildbad, the German Rossini Festival. We have another Rossini opera. I think L'Occasione fa il Ladro. We have a very interesting project from Portugal by the Portuguese composer Almeida. He was a late Baroque, early classical composer, and the opera is called La Spinalba, or The Crazy Old Man is the old title for it. That's quite a find, and it really occasionally reminds you of early Mozart. It's very good music. I really enjoyed when I... And it's done in Italian, because that was the language of opera at the time.
Right.
We have a Grétry opera in the pipeline. I think it's Le Magnifique, if I'm not mistaken. It's Opera Lafayette.
Oh, right, right. They're American company, right?
It's the Washington-based company. And then we have La Didone Abbandonata by Hasse. That is a co-production with the Munich Opera Studio. It features the Munich Court Orchestra and the top students from the opera studio.
So do these recordings mainly then take place live? Is this how you do it? Or are these still recordings in the studio?
It's live, but very often with a patch session. If things go wrong during the performance,
right,
we either do a patch session or we may record the dress rehearsal and the first performance or two performances. I mean, there are various scenarios. We have also coming up two operas by Peter Maxwell Davis. These are re-releases of the old Collins recordings. And then we have a contemporary opera by Ricky Ian Gordon, Rappahannock, the Virginia Symphony Orchestra with Joanne Falletta.
Right.
Well, it was a Virginia Arts Festival production.
Wonderful. So I mean, obviously the recording industry, especially around large-scale works like opera and symphony, has changed a lot in the 25 years of Naxos's existence. What do you see the future to be in terms of people's appetite for this kind of thing?
Oh, well, I'm afraid we still produce more than we should. We're still releasing about 30 new titles a month.
Right.
Actually, newly recorded titles, not re-releases. But nowadays, 20% of those are released only digitally for download and streaming, not physically.
Mm-hmm.
I expect that percentage to increase between now and, let's say, 2017.
Right.
So we still will have CDs and DVDs and Blu-rays 5 years from now, but maybe not so many titles will be released digitally, will be released physically anymore.
Right. It does seem that people are tending more to the download. I'm never sure in terms of the classical world how prevalent that is, certainly in pop music, but you know, it's maybe a little bit different with classical. I'm not sure.
Actually, downloads are still growing. I mean, not very fast, not very strongly, but they're still growing.
Mm-hmm.
Because the fastest growing segment is actually streaming by subscription.
So right.
We have this Naxos Music Library, which is growing dramatically, about 15-20% a year. We also have the Naxos Video Library, where you can now watch, I think, 380 operas, different operas online on demand. That kind of service is likely to increase dramatically. It may take up 50% of the market.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But the Naxos Music Library is incredible. I know I've used that a lot, and I wasn't aware of the video library until recently.
Of course, also the music library in particular is not just a musical jukebox, but it's a database. You know, it's an incredible source of revenue of information.
Well, I'd like to thank you very much for joining us this morning. Hopefully see you soon.
Yeah, see you. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. For our next segment, which is our regular In the News segment, I thought we would chat about a story that seems to have generated a lot of talk on all sorts of blogs and responses and letters. And this is a story about a performer called Amanda Palmer. She's formerly of the Dresden Dolls, their rock group, and she put out an ask for professional-ish, as she called it, classical musicians to play with her on a tour as volunteers. And this was part of a Kickstarter venture. And just to give you a little bit of background, Kickstarter basically is a way for artists to raise money for projects, for recordings or for tours. And the idea is that you put out there how much money you need and there's a deadline and then people donate. So this is one way of raising money. But I guess the real issue was this Amanda Palmer, there was a lot of controversy around the fact that she wanted, you know, very well-trained musicians to play for free. And I thought we would just talk about that a bit and just the implications of that for young musicians. And is this what it takes these days to to get yourself out there? I don't know.
There's many sides to this story. When you said we were going to discuss this, I actually own like a couple of Dresden Dolls CDs.
Oh, okay.
I was like, so I knew who you were talking about. I was like, oh, and I hadn't heard the story before you mentioned it.
Right.
I've always known that she's a very fan-based type of artist. Mm-hmm. And on the indie scale of things, she's very indie. Tries not to, you know, delve into the corporate world, but she kind of, in a way, became a corporation herself and is kind of doing what she wouldn't want other bands to do. That being said, she put this thing up on her blog that was, you know, we're going to do this tour that people have donated money to so we could do the tour. And I have a couple musicians already, but I want to fill it in with, you know, a couple of horn players, a couple of string players. You know, could you please have a professional-ish background? She said ish in the in the thing. And she basically said, you know, we don't want somebody who played the flute in fifth grade to come up. And, you know, it's weird because a lot of other bands have done this too. Green Day will do this. Well, they'll have some of their fans come up and play, but it'll just be like something at the end of the night and just a jam with them, kind of an experience. This, though, turned into a, you know, she asked for it ahead of time, and she said, you know, you won't get paid. You'll get paid in beer, high fives, and like merchandise.
Yeah.
So, which, as a fan, I mean, heck, if Dave Grohl came to me and said, could you sing backup for us for a year and I won't pay you, but you get to hang out with us, I'd be like, done, sold, I'm there. You know, if I was a fan of Amanda and I was a musician, I had a normal day job and just kind of wanted to go jam, that'd be awesome. But a lot of people now are like, well, what about the musicians who are actual musicians who want to work? And yes, there's an element of that, but I think the people who have studied, you know, 10, 15 years on their instrument aren't really waiting for the Amanda Palmer concert in, you know, a bar in Texas. So I can see that, I mean, the comment section on this blog was a revelation of craziness.
What we have mentioned is that she had raised, was it $1 million?
She raised $1 million. Some of that she does have to pay back.
She has all this money.
Yeah.
Surely she could pay.
And she will be making money at the door and money on the tickets.
Right.
So it is weird that she wouldn't, you know, at least give a little their way. Yeah. But it's not people she's hiring for her entire tour. It's every city is a different thing.
It's
so
it's a single gig.
Yeah.
This profit sharing isn't part of her model.
Exactly.
I don't have Dresden Doll CDs in my collection.
I had to look it up. I had to go online.
And I have to say, I'm very glad he did this, because actually she's an amazing performer.
It really is.
If you go on, you should go look at her on YouTube. I mean, she's got a whole series of her videos with Amanda Palmer, and it's appropriately the Grand Theft Orchestra, right? But she really is an astonishing performer. I much enjoyed seeing that. And I guess my reaction to it when I saw it was that, well, this is like between consenting adults. If you don't want to do it, just say no. And if you do want to do it, go do it. I mean, I it's a little bit strange, I know, but I can imagine. She did say professional-ish. I can see her going to play in a city where there's, you know, students, serious music students, and they, like you, would sort of go, I'm there. It's a performing opportunity, and it'll be a lot of fun to do. And she, but it was interesting because there's a lot of now discussion about it. And she actually wrote, I discovered, a long response to someone who, a professional musician who wrote about this from something called Classical, a San Francisco-based organization called Classical Revolution, I think, which sort of plays. It has chapters in various cities, and they play chamber music in all kinds of environments to work. And Amanda Palmer came back. It's a very long response, but she said one thing at the end. She said, you have to let artists make their own decisions about how they share their talent and time. And I think that's the bottom line of this. I mean, if you want to do it, you can argue whether, you know, she should have a profit-sharing model or not, but you know when you go into it, what's going to happen? You're going to get merchandise, high fives, and beer. And that's the deal. And a performing opportunity. And I thought about it. I mean, I don't, you know, perform, but I do write. I mean, I make a living out of writing, as Joe does over here. Or we try to make a living out of writing. And so I can't do it for free very often. But I tell you, I do write for free sometimes. And when I think about why I do it, well, it's because maybe I want to help somebody out, or because I like what they're doing. Or maybe it's just a project I want to do, and it's the only way I'm ever going to get to do it. So, I think musicians would probably approach it like that as well. I mean, if it's, it might be worthwhile to them in ways that go, you know, beyond monetary return.
I guess what I wanted to ask, because we have a professional singer in our midst today, especially for singers, it seems to me that, I don't know, maybe earlier on in your career you found this, you're often asked to perform for free.
Oh, dude, I sang at a pool party once with a tape, like Un Bel Di and something else. I'm not even kidding. Yeah. So we've all paid our dues.
Right, yeah. You know, I mean, there is that, you know, there is an issue around that, I think, sometimes, that there's this expectation that, you know, people don't realize, like, the number of years it goes in to become a classical singer, to become a classical musician, and that, oh, yeah, just get up at the party or whatever.
Oh, yeah, that's the big one.
You know, especially singing, you need, you know, no warm-up, nothing. Just get up and sing, right?
Yeah. And every time that happens, I always go, so what do you do? Yeah. Oh, well, I'm an accountant. Could you do my taxes for me right now? Could you show me how to do my taxes? You
know,
it's
response.
Yeah, it's, and even your family members, they do it all the time. You know, oh, I have this friend, she's having her daughter's getting married, or her third cousin's getting married, you're gonna sing for it. Oh, am I? Thanks, Mom. You know, it's kind of just expected. I think people see those, you know, old Hollywood movies where everyone's at a party and then everyone impromptu gets up and does a perfect dance routine that they've been rehearsing for 3 months, you know? People find it exciting. You know, they want to share something with you up close, and it's really intimate and really cool, but at the same time, you know, that's your job.
Exactly.
And people don't seem to think that your job is, I don't know, a real job.
Yeah.
Because it's a frivolous art adventure, you know? Yeah, I've had a lot of people do that whole thing where, yeah, just stand up and sing. Like, well, and then every single song you've ever sung goes out of your head immediately. You're like, I have no idea what I'm going to do, and yeah.
It kind of ties in a bit to this conversation that we've just listened to with Klaus Heyman, because when I was talking to him about the whole recording industry, I mean, this could be another huge topic for another time, but he did touch on, I said, well, you know, where do you see it all going? And, you know, he seemed to be saying that he feels that CD sales will continue to sort of decline and that a lot more stuff will be streamed and online. And, you know, I guess my question about this always is, you know, how are we going to pay the people to give us the content, and how is that all going to work?
In regards to the internet, when I was, you know, growing up, kind of like around middle school and stuff, you would have to go to the CD store or whatever and get just whatever CDs they had available, which was not a lot all the time. And then once YouTube came out and the internet, I got to see all of these performances that I wouldn't have ever seen or heard, you know, the old singers, things that really hadn't been recorded in a long time or readily available. So in that sense, it's great because younger people have access to a huge database of the history of our art form, which is fantastic. On the other side, you know, who's getting paid royalties or anything for that, you know, and it's kind of no one. And then the recording industry now, especially classical musicians, it used to be that if you wanted to do a CD, you'd go to the record company, oh, I want to make a CD. And now it's like you either have to be famous, independently wealthy, or have your own record label in order to produce something. Mm-hmm. Very rarely will people get asked to do anything like that anymore. I mean, you have recording artists now who, you got the biggies like Renee and Joyce DiDonato and Bryn Terfel and those kinds of people. Like, those are the people that are recording. But there are also independent labels, like the guy Philippe Sly, or is that how you say it? He just released a CD this week, and I forget which label it was.
Actually, you know, I don't think he funded it. I mean,
well, of course
government
not. Yeah,
funding.
Yeah, right, right.
Yeah, it's a smaller Canadian label.
Yeah. Also, he won the Montreal competition. I think that's part of the deal.
Exactly. See, you had to do something special, and it wasn't just like, oh, here's this.
Oh, I guess there's also this concept of crowdfunding, because I was thinking of Susie LeBlanc. Mm-hmm. You know, she is, you know, she's passionate about Elizabeth Bishop, who is an American poet, and she wants to put out a CD with Elizabeth Bishop's text and then other maritime things. And then, so she actually appealed to her fans. She the goal was to raise $50,000. And if you donate X number of dollars, you get this. And then if you donate more, you get, you know, these premiums. Mm-hmm. I don't know. You can even, if you give a lot of money, you can even sit in on a recording session.
Oh, cool.
And as far as I know, that CD is going ahead. Have any of you heard about that?
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, she's had a recording contract. I mean, she's done a lot of commercial CDs. So this is something different, right?
Yeah.
This is an independent project. I mean, we're getting into, it's social marketing. I mean, this is the whole area which is, people are only just beginning to explore. Indeed, it came up at the Opera CA meetings because the marketing of the opera companies is starting to sort of look into these areas as
Listen
well.
Listen to this. For $25, LeBlanc will send you a thank you card. If you give $500, she'll chat to you on Skype. If you give $1,500 level, you receive a week's visit to Bishop's childhood home. If you give $5,000, you can attend a rehearsal on a CD recording in August. So presumably it took place already. This was in the Globe and Mail.
I mean, well, that is very innovative marketing.
It is. It's wonderful marketing, and one wishes. Well, I mean, this whole area is so interesting now. The way people raise money, because the $1.2 million that Amanda Plummer raised was through social marketing. I mean, it wasn't like she went
Palmer. That's what
Palmer.
I thought too. At first, I thought it was Amanda Plummer.
No, oh, yeah. That's right. Palmer.
She's become an indie rock star.
Yeah, that's right. So yeah, no, it's really interesting. I don't know, and it. You know, it all links to this remarkable case, non-operatic, non-musical, of the poor woman in the U.S. who was bullied by her young charges on the bus, and the Canadian who, you know, just wanted to raise $5,000 so she could go on a vacation to forget about it, ends up, through the same kind of appeal, raising close to $750,000. Astonishing. Yeah. Power or potential in this, which I think is hardly explored at the moment, but one can see that it's just going to be become a mainstream form of marketing, I think.
Well, no doubt we'll come back to this topic in various forms over the course of these podcasts. I also recently chatted with Canadian soprano Jessica Muirhead, who just this past week was the first prize winner in the 49th annual Concours International de Chant de Toulouse. Jessica is an ensemble alumna from the COC, and in recent seasons at the COC, she's appeared as the Countess in The Marriage of Figaro, as Donna Anna in Don Giovanni, and most recently as Micaela in Carmen. And here's the chat I had with her when she was recently on holiday in Turkey, of all places.
So I'm curious, Jessica, you are quite an established singer now. You've been singing major roles in companies in Canada and in Europe. And so I'm just wondering, what is your impetus for entering competitions at this stage in your career?
Well, you know, I'm still young enough to enter them.
Right.
And I'm sort of at a stage in my career now where if I want to take it to the next level, I need a little bit of a boost.
Right.
And so, well, and also with the economy not being so great, some of my important gigs have been canceled.
Mm-hmm.
So it's also been a way to set myself some goals when I've had cancellations and long periods of a pausa, let's say,
yes,
in between. So it's been something to work towards. So that's why I've done some competitions. And I thought, well, you know, before I get too old, before I get past the age limit,
mm-hmm,
I thought I would try out another few competitions. And
wonderful.
Because the exposure, I mean, it's phenomenal with competitions,
that's
or can
sure
be.
It is. Well, that's what I wanted to ask you about, actually.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the Toulouse competition, which you just won, the female singer section, is that right?
Yep.
And can you tell me a bit more about the history of that particular competition? What is kind of the thinking around that competition?
Well, the real reason I wanted to do that competition was the panel, truly, just the
right
panel. And, you know, I stumbled across it, funnily enough, because, I don't know, when you're not in school, I find you're not kind of connected to the outside world in a way, especially not regarding competitions.
Right.
So I don't tend to hear about them unless they're right in front of me, you know.
Right.
You know, so Cardiff Singer of the World, of course, I've heard of that because it's on TV in London.
Mm-hmm.
But this Toulouse one, I was living in Nice over the summer, and I was going to visit a friend of mine in Toulouse. He was in Tannhäuser, I think it was, in the summer, and I wanted to see which performance date to go to, and I just clicked on their website, and it said, oh, the Concours de Chant, and I thought, oh, okay, what's this? And the deadline was like that day. It's always that way. And I clicked on it, and the panel was just to die for. And
wow,
on the panel was the casting director from the Royal Opera House, Covent Garden, who has heard me sing before, and he just recently hired me in February and March to cover at the Royal Opera House.
Oh,
but I
wonderful
thought, you know, I'd like him to hear me sing more repertoire,
because
mm-hmm he's really only heard me sing, you know, sort of two arias in a competition before, and then he didn't actually hear me when I was working at the Opera House because I didn't get to go on. I was, you know, just covering, and he didn't come to any rehearsals. So he was a real draw. I really wanted to sing for him again. And also, yeah, just there was the intendant from the Frankfurt Opera, who I really wanted to sing for again. I had sung for him a couple years ago, but, you know, I just wanted to remind them I'm still around and still singing well, I hope, you know. So he was on the panel, then also Paris. And also, I've never sung in France, and I love France, and that's it. After my few months in Nice, I thought, okay, I need to come to this country more if I can. So
right,
any excuse to come back, I will take. I absolutely love France. I have to say, I've fallen in love with it.
What were you doing in Nice? Were you training, like singing, taking lessons, or were you working there?
I was living my life.
Okay, enough said.
Yeah, you know what? I had months free, and I thought, oh, what am I doing in gray, rainy London that's overpriced when I could be somewhere sunny and warm and, you know, somewhere that wasn't going crazy preparing for the Olympics.
Right.
And I was supposed to be doing a Traviata in Toronto in the summer, so I had music to work on,
mm-hmm,
but I could do that anywhere, right?
Right, right.
And,
Total sense to be in Nice.
Did it ever. I don't know why I didn't come up with that idea before. Oh, sorry.
That's okay.
People are just coming out of a rehearsal right now. I don't know if you can hear.
A little bit. That's okay. It's ambient noise. That's fine. So what did you sing in the competition in Toulouse? I know Depuis le Jour was one of the arias.
Yeah. And, well, it was an interesting competition in that it was also, and this was another draw for me, it was it was sort of equally weighted with art song and arias, opera arias. Which is really nice because usually it'll be like an art song competition, or usually it'll be an opera competition, or they'll do an opera competition where you throw in one song, but it doesn't really have equal weighting or anything like that, right? So I feel kind of like sometimes the art song gets lost a bit. And I have to say, I don't get to do that many recitals. Mm-hmm. So I don't get to sing art songs as much as I would like. And really, that was, you know, that's what I did my master's in, actually, was solo song. So then, yeah, so this was, we had to give them 6 arias and 6 songs.
Amazing.
For the competition. And so for the first round, we were able to choose our own repertoire. But then for the semifinals and the finals, they chose from our repertoire. So for the semifinals, what did I do? I did Le Temps de Lila, the chanson.
Oh, I love that song. That's a great song.
Me too. Isn't it fabulous? Didn't he write amazing music?
Yeah, it's very dramatic. It's, you know, it's quite operatic in its own way, I would say.
I think all songs are, you know, I think they're all little mini Shanas. Mm-hmm. And then they asked for Sempre Libera.
Wow.
So I sang that, which is kind of my new favorite. I really, I love pulling it out. And it's funny because, you know, I've worked on that aria for years, mm-hmm. years and mm-hmm. years. And, you know, I get, you know, mixed, as we always do, I get mixed reactions when I tell people that I've been working on it. Mm-hmm. And they'll say, oh, don't work on it, don't work on it. So I've had sort of a chip on my shoulder about it over the years. And then finally, about a year ago, I pulled it out and I sang it for my manager. I had signed with new management a year ago. But it's a man who I've been sort of working with, and he's been kind of a mentor for me over the years anyway. Mm-hmm. So I sort of trust his opinion, and I know that he knows where my voice has been, where my voice is going. Like, he's I really trust him. And I said, look, I've worked on Traviata for a long time. My voice teacher's always telling me to bring it out. And the couple times I've brought it out, I've had mixed reactions. What do you think? And I sang it for him. And he said, well, I never would have thought you would be able to sing that the way that you do. So you have to bring it out from now on. Yeah, so I was thrilled when they picked Traviata. Right?
Wonderful.
Yeah, really thrilled. And then for the final round, they chose Depuis le Jour, which is great because that's my all-time favorite.
So your signature tune in a way.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, that's been a very good aria for me. It's been very good to me. And as you say, you know, I wish they did the opera more. I mean, the opera is stunning. But anyway, so I sang that. And what else did I do?
Well, it sounds like a lot. But anyway, you won with those.
Oh, no,
pieces.
You know what I did? I did Beim Schlafen. Yeah, I did. I sang Beim Schlafen gehen as well.
The Strauss song.
Yeah.
Right. And then that's what won you the competition, I suppose.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Well, congratulations again. I mean, that's especially for finding out at the last minute and getting in just under the deadline. I think you did pretty well.
Well, you know what? Those are the ones that always work best, actually.
Probably, yeah. Not overthinking it too much, you know.
Exactly.
Just going for it. Now you've gone from France and you're back in the sort of the colder climes. You're in Ireland, in Wexford, for their world-renowned opera festival. And you're singing an interesting role. Is it called Vreli? Is that how they say it? And this is in Frederick Delius's opera, A Village Romeo and Juliet, which is certainly a rarity in North America, maybe performed a bit more in the UK, but I don't think a lot. So can you just tell me a little bit about the role and the opera? And I mean, I know you've just started there, but obviously you've been working on the role, I'd imagine.
It's a fabulous opera. Mm-hmm. It is a real gem of an opera. It's hugely orchestral. I have to say that the orchestral writing is amazing, and there's probably way more for the orchestra than there is for any of the singers.
To most people, Delius, if he's known at all, it's for his orchestral tone poems, right? So that makes sense, yeah.
Yes, so it really shows in this opera, and really the way that he's written this opera is just stunning. I'm dying to get together with the orchestra. Really, just dying to, because the piano reduction just can't do the colors the orchestra will hopefully pull out. Just started rehearsals, so I'm just getting to know my team, and
this is very exciting.
So far, so good. I have to say, it's really a wonderful environment here.
Yeah,
everyone's so supportive, and it's very inspiring. I mean, I've only been here, I've only had 2 days of rehearsal, and I already feel like so motivated and so inspired. And it's been a while since I've rehearsed for an opera, you know, because I was without work for a few months.
Right.
And,
right.
You know, you kind of forget why you're in the business, I think, when you're sort of stuck home alone practicing by yourself.
Yeah. It can be kind of isolating, that part of it.
It really can. And it's tough to keep your momentum up, you know, it's tough to keep going, which again is another reason why I chose to do these competitions, to have a goal. But now I feel so alive and so just inspired, honestly. And it's so nice to sing with other people, you know, singing a duet actually with my tenor is so lovely.
The way it should be.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, thank you so much for catching up with us. We miss you here in Canada. We hope to get to hear you again soon, sometime over this side. But it's great to know you're busy in Europe and in the UK. We'll be, you know, looking for more information about this opera that you're in right now, for sure.
Well, lovely to chat with you. Give my love to everybody there.
I will. Hope to hear you again soon.
Yeah, hope so. All the best. Bye.
Bye-bye.
She's actually competing in Turkey right now. Lila Genca.
Oh, okay.
It's a competition.
Yes,
yeah,
she's into semifinals, and hopefully she'll win.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I just got an email from her about that. 20 semifinalists, she's in it.
Oh, fantastic.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Okay, then, so she wasn't on holiday.
No.
Although those kind of can be, like, you work and you get to
you enjoy
go to a
country.
It's kind of like paid vacation.
If she gets into the winner's circle, it will be her third this year. She came second in the Francisco Vineyards.
Oh, yeah.
In Barcelona.
I've done that one. Yeah, I was a winner 2 seasons ago. Mm-hmm.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did they treat you well?
They did. Yeah, I loved it there.
This is what? Barcelona.
In Barcelona, yeah. Galicia.
Yeah.
Not a bad city to be in again.
No, I'm excited. I go back there in like 2014, 15, somewhere around there.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Do you enjoy competitions, Tamara?
I do. I'm one of those weird ones. I guess I should tell the story. When I did the Met competition in the States, and I was 22, and it was my very first big competition that wasn't like at school or anything. And I just did it as a lark, just as an experience thing. And I got to I did my districts and I made it, and then I got to the regionals. And when I'm nervous or stressed, I like to paint and or draw or color. So my folks got me a coloring book right before I did it. I think it was like a California Chopper, like random motorcycle. It was he got it at a gas station. I was like, thanks, Dad. And then, so I'm back there, and I think I was second to last to sing, and I'm just sitting there in the thing coloring, and I was just totally relaxed trying to, like, not think about it. And then they announced who the winners were, and everybody backstage was like, oh my god, did you hear? That color book girl totally won. I was not people's favorite person that day. Yeah, I like competition. I like the fact that I'm going in front of people who have never heard me, never don't know me from Adam. And I can just prove something. It's like a here I am kind of a thing, as opposed to if I'm singing in front of family and friends, I freak out a lot. I can't do it. I think I'd much rather sing for like 10,000 strangers than, you know, my family. Because I guess it's because I hear about it afterwards, you know?
Well, thank you all. This has been a great conversation today, and hope to have you back again in the near future. Just to remind you, these podcasts are sponsored by DECA, the opera label. And again, the email address is community@coc.ca if you have any questions or comments, and we'll look forward to being with you again very soon.